Welcome to the B-Side, podcast number 7 of Tuas and Lyons Church on November 25th, 2013. My name is Rhoda Brooks. I'm your host once again for B-Side Today. And once again with me is Pastor Steve Croker,
hey,
lead pastor at TAC. Steve, how's your pneumonia? How much cold medication are you on? Do I need to be prepared for in this podcast today?
I'm not responsible for what I have to say. No, it's one of the finer lung infections I've had. Top three for sure.
Not fun.
No, it's pneumonia. What do you want?
How are you doing?
No, I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah,
feeling good.
It was good that Paul could like help you out a couple weeks ago by reading that big passage with all the names in it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I didn't know Paul was doing this today.
But yeah, I just got pneumonia, so I'd make him do it.
Oh, well, he did a good job.
Yeah.
It was long. Not quite as long as I think the one that you did before that, but now we're done the series.
Done
Nehemiah. I enjoyed it. That was good. I think a lot of people enjoyed it. I heard a lot of good feedback on the series. And now the big build side is sign is down.
Yeah.
Did you and Shirley go in and like kick the wall down or what?
It was hard to dislodge.
Did you graffiti the wall and then take it down?
No, that's not it. We kicked it down, yeah. It's like sitting in a pile in the back hall or something.
Oh. So if your kid has a need to get graffiti out of their system, no, maybe that just encourages it. We don't encourage that kind of behavior, I guess. You are really good about dates, facts and dates that I'm often not aware of. But I had noticed a lot of postings last week on Facebook about C.S. Lewis. So are there like important or interesting dates about C.S. Lewis floating around?
Oh, well, Friday the 22nd was the 50th anniversary of Lewis's death. He died November 22nd, 1963. And then this Friday, the 29th, is the 115th birthday. He died a week before his 65th birthday. So
he kind died of, younger. I didn't realize he...
Yeah, it wasn't quite 65.
Huh.
Yeah. So, it's sort of a lot going on because of the anniversary. I think there's some big things. And there's a big commemoration at Westminster Abbey.
Oh, I did. I saw a posting about that. He finally got some recognition.
He got a plaque near Shakespeare or something.
Oh, that's cool.
In the Abbey or something like that. So there's kind of a lot of anniversary celebrations. But Desiring God did their conference on Lewis in the fall.
Oh.
Like back a couple months ago.
Okay.
So there's just a lot of stuff going on with Lewis. So remembering. And he's had a huge impact. I mean, for an Anglican...
that was a loaded comment.
Well, he's an Anglican layperson. He would not have called himself a theologian. He was never a pastor, just an academic. His expertise was literature, and yet his books are widely read. In Catholics read his books, across Protestantism, evangelicals love them. So like, he's had such a diverse impact.
Wait, because he writes a lot of his writing is quite varied in even the genres that he writes in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, like, if you could pick, name your top two C.S. Lewis books, two or three. I don't know. You're such a big reader. Can you narrow it down to that? But if you were to pick, like, your personal top.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone ought to read Mere Christianity. I mean, it was originally just some broadcasts he did on the BBC during the war. Time, and it was sort of an apologetics type of the defense of the reasonableness of Christian faith, and then it was published later into a book, and I mean, it's got to be one of the most influential, significant books.
He wasn't a Christian, and he wrote that after he became a Christian.
Yeah. He was not a Christian when he was teaching, when he was initially teaching at Oxford, and it was through his friend Tolkien and through the Inklings that he came to faith. And you can read that. That's in Surprised by Joy, sort of his autobiography.
Mm.
It's not a bad book. It's pretty good. But I'd say everyone ought to read Mere Christianity. And then I've also really enjoyed, Screwtape Letters is fascinating.
You should explain what Screwtape Letters is.
Screwtape Letters is like an older devil writing to a younger devil on how he should tempt his person. You know, so it's sort of a fictionalized idea
of ways to try to trip.
Yeah, there's devils, demons that are out there trying to tempt Christians, and so it's sort of like you're looking at the world in reverse. But it's a really fascinating insight into the human condition as this older devil explains to this younger devil how he should trip up his human and cause him to stumble. And it's really good. It's really insightful. The Weight of Glory. It's a great little book.
I haven't actually heard of that book.
Yeah, it's a shorter collection of like essays. And the first one is The Weight of Glory, and it's very, very, it's been very influential, and he's explaining the role of desire and joy in Christian life. I mean, it would sound very, very John Piper-ish, but that's, it's a good one. I mean, I think another one would be just everyone should read the Chronicles of Narnia. And I think we often just kind of relegate it to kids' books, but I mean, the imagery and the storytelling is phenomenal. And if you read it theologically, it's quite something. I'm reading it with, I mean, even young kids, I'm reading it with Noah, and yet we're reading it on very different levels because I get what he's doing in certain descriptions and certain things. And there's certain images which just really stick with you and are powerful. My favorite would be when like Eustace turns into the dragon in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Mm-hmm. He puts on the dragon's gold. He covets the dragon's gold, the dead dragon's gold, and puts on the bracelet, and then he wakes up and he is the dragon, and sin has corrupted him and taken him over and changed his very being. And yet in the process, it's also, there's also this repentance there, and it's a change of his character. But he wants to get the dragon off, and Aslan tells him to remove the dragon's skin, and he claws at himself, and he removes a layer. He removes a layer and another layer, and he just keeps going dragon, you know, layer after layer. And he can't do it. He can't de-dragon himself. But then Aslan has to do it for him. But it's painful. It's the most painful experience, as Aslan and his claws have to tear away and undo the dragon and then throw him into the pool. And he comes out clean and fresh and whole and new. And there's this whole kind of conversion imagery, which is very, very powerful. I don't think Noah got it, but it was quite rich. It's quite profound. There's things like that. They're just that he scatters throughout, where there's these little sentences in there where you're just like, wow, that's very, very rich. And most readers probably just skip past them. But.
Oh, I love the series, the Narnia series. It's up there. It's one of my, yeah. I just love that he can, the same thing you're saying, that he can take all that imagery and mm-hmm. convey some really heavy concepts using this beautiful imagery. Mm-hmm. And Focus on the Family had actually done an audio, like a radio program of the whole series. And it was done so well, like not cheesy, really high quality. Mm-hmm. And I remember a few years back, I had been really ill for a time, and I had gotten that. I don't remember where I got it from. But anyway, I would listen to it at night when I went to sleep, mm-hmm. and I was wrestling with things with God. It made a lot to do with my health and stuff, and it just took me beyond myself. It took me into greater picture, like bigger mm-hmm. concepts, and it was awesome. I really love it. And I've reread it a couple times. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying my age on the podcast, but I'm not a kid, and I still really love it. Yeah, that and Lord of the Rings I also love.
Yeah.
They're similar but different, but again, with Tolkien and doing some of the imagery and concepts that he's trying to get. Yeah. I love that kind of stuff. I noticed you had a different book. I don't know what it's about in your office, but it had something to do with hobbits.
Yeah.
What was that about?
There's a good book I'd recommend it. I just got it. I read it about a year ago, called by a guy named Louis Marcos, Marcos, called On the Shoulders of Hobbits. And it's called, the subtitle is The Road to Virtue with Tolkien and Lewis. And he just writes about virtue and these classical virtues and pulls them out of the Narnia stories and the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit stories and uses them as a vehicle to discuss the classic virtues. It's a great, great book. It was good. It was like kind of an analysis and unpacking the theology and themes. It's good. On the Shoulders of Hobbits, On the Road to Virtue, Tolkien and Lewis. It's a good book. Louis Marcos, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
well, speaking of reading, there's two things. Now, I'm not the same book devourer that you are. When I talk about what I've read in a week, it looks nothing like what you've read in a week. But I just happened to pick up a couple things this week. I picked up a really popular magazine of Canadian Living and the December one.
I haven't read that one.
No, you haven't? No. It's shocking. It has like all these cool cookie recipes, and
yeah,
Megan and Emma and I are doing it for the bake sale on Sunday. So like that's why I bought it. But then I was flipping through and I saw this interesting article, and it made me think about your sermon a few weeks ago when you talked about interfaith marriage, and it has this whole article in here. And this is actually, I know you haven't read this, but this is a really popular magazine, and the article is called A Matter of Faith, The Joys and Challenges of Raising Kids in a Mixed Religion Household. And I thought, this should be interesting. And what I found, I can't read the whole article here, but what I found interesting in the title, it says the joys and challenges. So obviously they're extolling this endeavor by people. Mm. But then when I read the article, I couldn't find the joys. Like, I could only see the challenges in it, which I found interesting since they're the one putting forth the article. But like the first couple, she's a rabbi, he's a Roman Catholic. They discuss their religions and their faith before they got married. And I found it fascinating because it took me aback. Like, she's saying, our household is Jewish. There's no Christian symbols. Before they got married, they had all these discussions. And she says, it was important that there be a clarity of path to avoid any confusion by mixing religions. And then it says her husband's just as devout in his religious life, but practices Catholicism apart from the family. And then it talks about he goes to Mass and he goes to synagogue. And then she actually writes, the more a person is involved in the religion, the harder it is to be with someone of a different faith. So she's actually acknowledging this mm-hmm. fact. And then it goes on to talk about this divorced couple and how they deal with it, and another couple where he does not have of any particular faith, and she is Christian faith, and it talks about them trying to work that out. But what really got me, so that I just reading this article, I'm like, well, this is fascinating. I don't feel like they're making a strong case for this. Mm-hmm. And then the last paragraphs, though, is from this psychotherapist. And it says, in the end, don't we want our kids to be open-minded about the world? It's healthy for kids to learn to read and look for meanings and be curious. Where mixed faith parents fail is using religion as a form of a power play, as a way of getting their children to agree with them and disagree with their spouse. That's a whole other issue. Regarding what's right and wrong, this can be confusing for kids. Christmas can be used to expose kids to different beliefs. It's much more healthy than an autocratic approach in which one religion is presented as the only right way to live or celebrate. Blind faith is problematic. Children raised in those type of environments have difficulty coping with life outside the religion, and they have trouble thinking outside the box. Teaching them to embrace and respect differences is a wonderful gift that opens their world. So I'm just thinking about Christian parents. Well, I guess there's two subjects in here. One is the one you're talking about of interfaith marrying and what some of the costs are to that. Mm-hmm. So I guess it would be great to talk about that. And also, like, what are your thoughts for a Christian parents reading this and getting these worldviews on parenting? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the text in Nehemiah, they're very adamant about, in God's law, about not marrying the people of the other races. Like, it comes up a few times in Nehemiah. It came up again in chapter 13 because they started to marry the neighbors around them. And, I mean, it's not about interracial marriage because we also have the Old Testament examples of interracial marriage. You think of, like, Ruth. But the point is their faith and obedience, and are they part of the covenant people of God or not? And so that principle carries over for sure to the New Testament, where I would say, should a Christian marry a non-Christian? No, I would say they should not. I would even say, should a strong, devoted Christian marry a sort of cultural Christian or sort of someone that says, I mean, I think this, in Paul's words about being equally yoked or unequally yoked, I mean, that would apply too, I think, to someone who's like, I'm a devoted Christian who's going to serve God with my life, and this person over here attends church and is sort of a Christian, they would claim to be, but is not going to be a strong, compatible, you know, leader or is going to drive you forward and challenge you. I mean, you want in your marriage to be married someone who not only you share your faith, but you encourage each other in your faith. You're driving, your marriage shouldn't hinder your walk with Christ, but should enhance it. Mm. Right. And so marrying someone who's outside Christian faith is going to always hurt your faith, not enhance it. And so it's the most important relationship you have. And so that most important relationship should be driving your worship and your, like, should be helping and motivating, stimulating your worship and your walk with Christ. And I mean, like we said in the message a few weeks ago, like, it might seem great when you're dating, getting engaged and stuff like that. And, oh, no, we're really compatible and it's great and they're special and it's not like that. And yet I've been around enough. I've seen enough of the stories where give it some time and it always hurts. There's always a cost. And
even if the cost, sometimes the cost is big. Like in some of this article, like sometimes the cost is big. And other times, it's like you say, where people, it might not seem like there's a huge cost in the sense that there's huge hurt, but if it holds you back from experiencing God on a stronger mm-hmm. level or worshiping mm-hmm. God on a stronger level, then that's still a cost.
It's going to be a lot of heartache down the road.
So it sounds like wise advice, but what about the people who are all, so what does that say for the people who are already believers and married to unbelievers? Or have, you know, like, yeah. What hope is there? Like, yeah, what is that saying for
I mean,
them?
There's, so you can say that to those who aren't yet married, and I would caution them, and I would urge them to only consider marrying someone who would, stimulate their faith and not hurt it. But for those who are, I mean, whether one spouse gets converted and the other one's not yet, or whether, whatever it may be, whatever, however situation you find mm-hmm. yourself, I think the Christian spouse should stay in the marriage and cultivate it and use it as an opportunity to share Christ, both live it out and to share Christ with words with their spouse and be faithful to their spouse, because those are calls that God has put on their life. And it's going to be harder than for others, but that's the road that God has called them to walk, and they're there for that purpose. So that doesn't mean we should all bail on those mm-hmm. situations. Now there's going to be challenge. I mean, we don't have to pretend it's just because you're married to a Christian spouse that it's all rosy and easy either, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so you can
people can make arguments for that as well.
You could also kind of paint it black and white, like, if only I was married to a Christian spouse, then, you know, I'd have like a full-time person building into me. It's not quite that way either, right? So there's challenges. There's going to be challenges in every marriage. But so, you know, for those who are in that situation to just...
But at least you have a common place that you're working from. So yeah. We have those discussions.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So there's value there, definitely. But so, you know, my heart does go up to those who don't have that, but they have an opportunity to uniquely represent Christ in their marriage and to honor their spouse still and lovingly fulfill their marriage vows and to represent Christ. And they're still called to that.
But it wouldn't be your advice to therefore hear that and go missionary date someone.
No, I wouldn't.
Hoping that some point in their marriage that they'll
it can be okay, but it usually isn't. There's a lot of cost and a lot of heartache. And we could bring out all sorts of people that would tell us, yeah, I love my spouse, but this is way harder because of this, you know, and to who would urge younger people to not do what they did. It's not a model to follow.
Okay, so, well, that's part one of that article, obviously, right. Is you don't have interfaith families if you don't have interfaith marriage. It's funny how that works.
Yeah, connection there.
Yeah, and then the next part goes in, so I read that article in the magazine, but then in our own Self Delta Leader, mm-hmm. Kind of going to the second one, one of the writers in under Viewpoint wrote an article called Uncommon Sense. And of course this is his opinion on this, but I thought it was interesting because he starts off as part of the reward of parenthood is being able to shape young minds into a worldview you feel is beneficial. He talks about that it's a way to guide them into the right path, which I found it interesting that he used the word right path in his mm-hmm. article, because then he goes on and he has very strong opinions about parents involving kids in their politics. And then halfway right. through that, I was waiting for it. Like, I'm reading through it going, when are we going to hit religion? But then he said, I'm reminded greatly of the same sort of indoctrination that takes place on young children by religious groups who prey on impressionable minds at a time when they're least able to resist. It's one thing to present God as a possible explanation for the existence of life in the universe. And it's quite another to threaten a child with hellfire and damnation if they don't believe in the magic man in the sky. Those are his words.
That's what we do. Yeah,
he is a magic man. And
magic man.
Yeah, and he talks about... So he has some questions here, and I thought, so I'll pose his questions to you. As a parent, do you want your child to mindlessly repeat your own words without a foundation of understanding necessary to form an opinion? Would you rather provide your child with critical thinking skills so that they can one day make their own informed choice? So it's a heavy, like, and then he goes to talk about his own experience in his childhood with his leftist
it's really bad childhood communist, history. But yeah. That's not motivating his entire, slanting his entire worldview, his unfortunate upbringing.
Like, apparently he was not able to play hockey because he was doing political rallies. I can understand that. As a child, you would be a bit bitter towards
him. He doesn't have an axe to grind, though.
No. Yeah. No. But, like, reading this, I thought this is interesting because the Bible is quite strong on the role of parents.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But then I think sometimes people misinterpret that as the attempt to brainwash or not have the children have their own. So how do I form this as a question to you? Those are my questions to you. Reading that, as a Christian parent reading that and feeling discouraged and intimidated, how do Christian parents at TAC regain their confidence in what their role is?
I mean, that article is unfortunate because it's instead of actually dealing with the issue, and the question of what should we teach our children and should we just let them decide for themselves, he actually just sets up a massive straw man. Like, the options are, how did he put it? Options were to like what was the mindless indoctrination?
He's reminded of the same sort of indoctrination that takes place by religious groups. All right, hold on.
He says, what was it?
Steve is searching for his
question. Do you want your child mindlessly repeating your own words without a foundation of understanding necessary to form an opinion? Or would you rather provide your child with critical thinking skills? Like, those are the options. You can give them critical thinking skills, or you can have them mindlessly repeat. And this is a massive straw man where they, anyway, it's really quite.
But I'm sad to say, even in our churches, and I've gone to children's workers conferences, so there's children's pastors from all other churches. And I know that one of the things culturally that we struggle with in churches today is a generation of parents who are like, oh, I think it's good to bring our kids to church, but we don't, my kid decide when they're six if they want to go to church or not. I'll let my kid decide how they feel about that. And they're, I feel like things, articles like this can feed that.
Well, of course, we don't want our children to just mindlessly repeat, and we're not here to indoctrinate our children and brainwash them. We're here to teach. We have a responsibility as parents to teach our children. Part of it is, I guess, the question of, is there truth out there? Is there truth that could be known or not? Because if you're of the postmodern mindset that would say there's no one objective truth, everyone has their own truth and everyone has the right to their own truth, and as long as you're sincere, that's all that matters, then if that's your foundation, then you would just say, yeah, I'm going to raise my kid and teach them there's 10 options and let them choose which option they want, because all the options are equally valid, right? So if you're adhering to that foundational principle of postmodernism, then the right way to parent your children would be just give them options and let them choose, because every option is equally valid. And so the best way to love your children would be to tell them all of the options, because there's no bad option. Just pick one. Buddhism, Hinduism, they could be Sikh. Let them just do whatever they want. Let them choose for themselves. However, if that's not the way the world works, if there is truth and there is something that is true and there's something that is false, if there are ideas that are right and ideas that are wrong, then the kind and loving thing as an older person, right? Like, usually the parents are supposed to be older and they're supposed to be able to teach their children something. But we're not equals here.
Yeah.
It's almost like the way people approach it. Like, you and your children are equals in this relationship. Your partners in this. No. There are older people in the family who are to teach younger people in the family, and not the reverse. And yet some parents haven't clued in that because they're older, that gives them a position of authority. You named your children because you're an authority over them. And so you are there to teach and lead and to make decisions. But if there is truth and there is right and wrong, then the loving thing to do is not to just say all the options are available to you, but instead is to instruct and teach them what is the truth and what is false. What is right? What is wrong? There are certain things that should be believed because they are right and true, and there are things that should not be believed because they are false and wrong. And so it's a question of foundationally is, what do we believe about the world? And is there something that is objective and true out there? And if so, we should teach our children what is objectively true and not just let them blindly stumble into something false. I mean, that would be poor parenting. So, I mean, part of this whole idea of you shouldn't really teach your children what to think. You should let them decide for themselves. To me, this is insane.
I feel like, have you met a two-year-old? Seriously.
You don't just let your children decide whatever they want when they're like young like that. Like that your job is to parent them, to lead them, to teach them, to help them. At 3 years old, at 5 years, they're not really in a position to just be making massive decisions on their own, right? Like in the end, your kids, as they grow, our children will make decisions on their own. And that's what we do want that ultimately. We're trying to raise them to be adults, to be able to think clearly and fairly and objectively, and to be able to make decisions. It's not how it works. You can't just indoctrinate children and then they're going to become
Christian. I've never actually
Christian.
Seen that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like,
watch
kids grow up in church and they come to a point where they make a decision for themselves.
Yeah.
And nobody else then goes, no, you're 20 and forget that. And,
yeah.
Like, I haven't actually seen it happen.
It doesn't just work that way where someone's going to, like, if you teach them when they're five, then they're going to mindlessly repeat this for the rest of their lives and they're going to die that way. It's just it doesn't work that way. So there will come a point where a children will have to make their own decision. But it's not kindness. It's not respectful. It's not loving to therefore not teach your children what is true and what is false and let them fall and make all the same mistakes and hurt themselves and destroy themselves. This is not kindness.
Well, I guess, it comes down, I could see how people who don't know Christ and don't share that worldview, then I could see how that the view that he's putting forth fits culturally.
Yeah.
But if you really believe in God, in his son, in his plan, and the truths of heaven and hell and all that, and then you're too worried about teaching that to your children because your children will come back one day, what if your child comes back? Like, what do you say to your child who you never taught that to? And then they're like 26 and like, why didn't you make this important?
So
in
you
my
told
life?
Me that God revealed himself in the scriptures and you knew it and you didn't tell me that?
Yeah, right? Like, what are you going to feel worse about? Or going like, or a child growing up and going, you know what? The Spirit hasn't called them yet and they don't understand that. But that I'd rather have it that way that I shared than not took my responsibility seriously and they called it on me later as an adult who comes to Christ.
And more significantly, that God called you on it later.
Yeah,
you have a responsibility
yeah.
before God to teach and train your children, to shepherd, to parent them.
Yeah, and you only have so long to do it,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so there, if you hold this view, which is culturally is the view, that all views are equally valid, then you raise your children in such a way that you don't tell them anything. You don't tell them... The only thing you tell them is that all views are valid. You can decide for yourself because every view is valid. And so we teach tolerance in the new definition of tolerance. And we talked about this on Sunday. There's the old definition of tolerance, which the word tolerant, if you look it up in a dictionary, that what tolerance really means is that you and I disagree about something, but we're able to have respect.
Agree to disagree.
Yeah, tolerance is how you behave towards people you disagree with. There's a fundamental understanding that we believe different things, but we're tolerant. In other words, we're able to get along. I can disagree with you without killing you or being mean to you. I can love you and be kind towards you even though we see it differently. Yeah. I'm tolerant. But that's not the definition that people work with today.
No.
The new definition of tolerance is we always have to agree. There's no wrong answers in the new tolerance.
But if you actually don't agree... then you are a racist, a bigot, a hateful person because you refuse to actually share the same beliefs.
Intolerance used to speak towards behavior, and now intolerance speaks towards belief. Simply having a view that is different is viewed as intolerance. And so we have redefined what the word means and then made it the only sin of our culture is intolerance. And so teaching your children that you're teaching them beliefs, teaching them truth. So if you teach your children that Christ is the only way of salvation and other ways, there's other religions, but they are not a means for salvation, that would be massively intolerant and the only thing you could do wrong in the new definition of tolerance and in the view of our culture. Versus in the older definition, what you do is you teach them that that Christ is the only way of salvation, but that there's people out there that don't believe that, and we ought to love them and care for them. We ought to be kind to them. Just because some of the kids in your class at school are Christians and some are not, we still treat all the kids in your class with kindness and love because God has called us to love all people.
Which I agree with.
Which
would be the switch is that now people won't accept that back.
Yeah.
Which I find interesting. That takes me back to Screwtape Letters. I'm like, if C.S. Lewis is here, like, this would be a great argument, or like this whole thing of switching the whole cultural ideology
conversation,
and all of a sudden it's, the tolerance has had it's just slowly been creeping in over time, and it has a new definition. Which is what's happening, but
yeah, I mean, that's been
the enemy from, is not stupid, right?
From the modern way of looking at the world to the postmodern way of looking at the world came with a new definition of what tolerance is. So,
And I guess for Christians, that can feel overwhelming or intimidating, but then we got to go back to the Word, and we still have the Word and what God says about parenting, and and one day, you know, it's better to have that awareness and fear of God rather than fear of man. What's more important in the big picture?
And I mean, we do want to teach our kids to think and to understand and to see that there's different views. They're not all right.
Because you want to prepare to deal with that, though, too.
But yeah, I mean, we want to teach our children how to think and how to think through the issues as they get older and older. And that's where there's, you know, the role of apologetics and philosophy and theology come in. We don't just, you know, if you're just mindlessly filling your kid with information, it won't stick.
Yeah.
But it's to teach our children how to think objectively around the Christian faith and whether the claims of Christ are true or not. That is what we want to do. We want them to think and to use their minds to engage with the truth claims of the Christian faith and to discern for themselves, is this true and right? But we can resource and teach and train them to think wisely around those things, not to fall into the same old traps that our culture keeps falling into time and again.
Well, that was good. That is, that's what I was reading this week. I thought it fell well into, as we're wrapping up the series in Nehemiah. Speaking of wrapping up the series in Nehemiah, we did have a question that was sent in to us here. And it says, it's actually in regards to the sermon that was on chapter 9 of Nehemiah. In that sermon, the children of Israel confessed personal and ancestral sin. How does this apply today to Christians, if at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked about chapter 9. They confessed their own sin. They also confessed, like, the pattern of sin of their parents and the previous generations. So, I mean, you know, some people might kind of stumble over that, like confessing your parents' sin. It's not that we're accountable for what our parents did wrong, or grandparents, like in the sense that, you know, God's going to hold us to account for the sins of previous generations. It's not like that. But by naming my parents' sin as sin, I'm able to break with the pattern. Because if I'm in, like, you have two options, I think, with your parents' sin, for instance, or your ancestral sin. If you can either justify it, and then you're bound to repeat it, or you can name it, call it what it is, and then you, and by God's grace, break the cycle. So if there's a cycle of alcoholism, or if there's a cycle of abuse or different things that kind of are behaviors that are passed on one generation to the next and are often repeated. What we're talking about is by naming that and calling it what it is, then you have the hope of by God's grace moving beyond it. But when we're self-justifying, and if they're making excuses for their parents and their previous generations, then you're very likely to repeat those same mistakes. And so it's not that God's going to hold me accountable for the sin of my dad or my mom or my grandparents, but every individual has to give an account for their own life. So when we're confessing, we're not repenting of their sin so that we're not, you know, being judged by it, or we're not, you know, it's not about that, but it is about naming it and calling it what it is so that there's a hope and a future apart from that, by God's grace. So that's more what we're getting at there. And I think that's more the point. Yeah. It's more about moving forward than it is about, like, oh, we're going to be held accountable for that or not. But we're going to be held accountable for our own sin and our own issues, which will repeat our parents if we don't make that break. Yeah.
Okay, well, we have, before we sign off for today and just mention a couple of upcoming things, there was one more question that was sent in here. It wasn't about the sermon, but it says, "Hi, B-Side team, I like your name." Thank you, writer. "Since I've listened to portions of a couple podcasts, the pre-service prayer may have been discussed without my knowing it." So this writer's talking about the prayer time at 9:15 on Sunday mornings before the service. That's open to anyone. "When the clocks went back, I thought that extra hour or more might show up, but that wasn't the case. Any thoughts on why that wasn't so?"
Yeah, so we gather, it's actually like about, what, it's supposed to be 9:15, but it's really like 9:25. We gather in the sanctuary group of people and pray, and sometimes it's just a handful of us, like four or five, and sometimes there's like about 15, 20 people gather and pray, and we wanted to just devote each morning to God and His glory, and invite God to, and call on God to work in our midst through the proclamation of the word and through singing and through all the different things that may be happening on a particular Sunday, recognizing that all the things we plan and prepare aren't going to accomplish the things we're really after, the life change that we're really after. And so we pray and gather and pray and dedicate that. And just, we have, you know, some of the elders, some just different people in the church come and pray, and that's awesome. So we invite anyone to come join us. Like 9:25 in the sanctuary on every Sunday morning we gather. I mean, there's a lot going on at that time. On any given Sunday, we need about 40, as many as 50 volunteers on a Sunday to make a Sunday morning happen.
I don't think people realize that, because a lot of times they're not all lined up saying volunteers today.
Yeah. Like between tech people, band on the stage, communion servers,
children's
ministry, kids classes, sign in, people making coffee, people in the info center. Like, there's a lot of people that have everyone doing their little bit, ushers. So we need literally dozens and dozens of people each doing their little bit. So it can be chaotic at that time just before service starts. And so there's lots going on, but yeah, we definitely love to have people gather and pray with us, and praying, whether it's beforehand or at home, or showing up at 9:25 and praying with us that God would be at work in our Sunday mornings. And
I love that we do that, though, because I feel like there's so much work and effort and detail that goes into every Sunday morning, and it's done for the love and glory of God, but it's so much detail that I love that we put it back on the altar before it all goes down.
We used to the band would practice until like 9:56, and then we'd pray for like 1 minute quick before everything got rolling. But then we moved everything back, and so there's this break, this half an hour where we could come and pray. And I think it's been good. It's good. So there's a focus and there's a perspective. And yeah, you could keep rehearsing. You could keep planning and preparing. There's probably more things you could do to get ready, but we're going to stop and say that's enough, and now it's time to call on God to work.
So if you're listening to this podcast and you weren't even really maybe aware of the prayer time, and you can come at 9:20 on a Sunday morning and join the group,
join us in the sanctuary.
So if you're wondering, if you come into church and you like see a group of people sitting in the sanctuary, that's what they're doing.
Just come a little
and
bit
it's
early.
Open, it's not a specialized group of people.
No.
Yeah.
Just come early and pray with us. We'd love it.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Well, we've got two things coming up.
Yeah.
Speaking of prayer and getting together for corporate prayer, why don't you talk about what's happening on Sunday night?
Oh, yeah. Encounter. So every couple months, we do one of these worship prayer nights. We just wanted to get our church together, be singing more, be praying together. And as we head into the Advent season, next Sunday is the first Sunday in Advent, and there's a number of changes, things happening, staff changes, and Christmas time. And so we really wanted to be just setting aside time to be praying about those things as we head into the Advent season.
It's kind of like Sunday mornings, but for like a season. It's like we're gathering together before a season to kind of give it back.
So that's Sunday night, 7 o'clock, 7 to 8:30. Join us and pray and sing. And they've been really great. I really enjoy the encounter nights. Just to sing together, pray together. We have different people speaking and sharing and calling us to pray about certain things. And so
it doesn't look like a Sunday morning.
No, it's different. Yeah, it's good. It's complement. It complements Sunday morning. Yeah. Similar but different.
Yeah, so people are trying to figure out what to expect. It has a different
kind of layout. We gather and sing and pray in groups and then sing some more and pray some more and sing some more and pray some more.
And
it's, it's always really good. It's been a great, great evening together. So
it's a great way to start off really the Advent season and people are trying to refocus even in, for them corporately, but also for themselves.
Yeah, we want to see God. We want to see people meet Jesus. We want to have God working in our midst in the Advent season and through our staff changes and through, Ralph and Ruth are going to be there sharing about getting ready for them leaving in, on the 16th they're leaving. So they're going to share and we'll be praying for them. So just a good opportunity to kind of focus on some of these things and to pray and to worship together. So that's great. Hope everyone can make it out Sunday night, 7 p.m.
Yeah. And then you can invite all your friends and family out to Marian Bright, which is like the next Sunday.
Sunday the 15th.
Yes. That's a lot of fun.
6:30.
Yes. Yeah, 6:30. Gatlin is putting it together again, and he always does a fantastic job.
Yeah.
If you want to invite your family and friends to something that's just really, I don't know how to explain it. You can't call it low-key because it's done so well, but it's not like, it doesn't feel like a massive Christmas production in the sense of like what people might associate with that in like major scripted storyline or play or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's always so good and people enjoy it. And then we have that whole desserts after, which, you know, really is always a win.
Yeah.
So
desserts.
Yeah, desserts. We just cap it off with desserts.
What I love about this time of year, Rhoda, is
food.
Is that people who love us bring things to us.
Oh, are you putting a shameless plug out there for stuff?
No, all kinds of things like funeral home or like businesses that we use at the church. So they bring like chocolate to the church. Just like almost every day someone's bringing by chocolate.
Which is so good because you never plan your meals. You're just like, we call you the duck. You just graze off of like what's sitting here.
Whatever's laying around.
Yeah, whatever's laying around.
So it's the time of year when people bring us food at the office.
Just so you just had that plug from Steve there.
So
but
if you have food, you know where I am. Monday
all
to
right.
Friday.
Well,
Monday
on that note.
Come by. Bring your food.
All right. So we're going to wrap it up for today. We're glad you could join us. And we hope to touch base with you next week on our next podcast.
Send in your questions.
Send your questions in. We love the questions. It's so good. So at bside@tawassonalliance.org. See you later.
Bye.